Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So glad you're here with us on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever rip you off. Our websites, clark.com and clarkdeals.com. I just got an email from my insurer for auto telling me that I was getting a price cut because of how few accidents and the costs that they're experiencing insuring me at my insurer. Now, I am with a mutual insurer where it's essentially owned by its policyholders, so the savings end up being passed on to me. But I saw industry data recently that found that insurers, after being pretty generous early in coronavirus, in the spring, at giving money back to policyholders, now have decided they're much more likely holding on to that money and just making much, much larger profits. And so we've got this split going on where the insurers are seeing driving totals much lower than they would normally have been for the summer driving season, but nothing like what in the spring when so many states were in lockdown and we were talking about how many weeks per gallon of fuel instead of how many miles per gallon, and talking about people who were getting rodents inside their engines because they weren't driving their vehicles at all and all that. I mean, we're past that, but driving will remain down even for a while, even as coronavirus ultimately recedes as a threat, just because it will take a number of potentially years for the economy to fully recover. So miles traveled will be lower for that reason. And then as so many people who work in office kind of environments have had the ability to work from home, that genie is not going to be put back in the bottle completely. So there'll be less commuting in the future, less driving during rush hours around the country. And the result is that auto insurers, unless they cut their rates, are going to be making just bonkers profits. As a general rule, you know, insurance is regulated by the states overall, not the federal government. And in many states, the insurance department in the state is what's known as a captive or captured regulator, where they serve the interests of the insurers rather than the insureds. Certainly not in every state, but it is a problem where insurers have been able to hold on to money instead of rebating it back to policyholders. So that puts the responsibility on you and me to go shop our insurance, because there are going to be wide gaps that open up. If you personally are driving a lot less and you don't see yourself going back to the level of driving you used to do, you need to be on the lookout for pay-by-the-mile auto insurance. Something that's been a niche of auto insurance, a small part, and available in many states, but not every state. But if you are in a significant change in how much you drive and you see that being your future as well, then paying by the mile for auto insurance could save you substantially. Now, another thing. Oh, and the way you find that, say, auto insurance, do a search with whatever search engine you use. Auto insurance by the mile and then put your state name in. And then you'll see if anybody is selling by the mile insurance where you live. Now, here's another odd factor to share with you that I saw. I forget which financial publication I saw. It may have been Barron's. I don't remember exactly which one I read, that homeowners insurers are seeing a great reduction in claims and what they have to pay out. And the reason for that is, ironically, the other side of this thing with people driving less. People are in their homes more, which has driven down the claims for burglaries. Burglars don't want to be there with the possibility that you are also there. So the crimes of opportunity that burglaries generally are way down, and so you're much less subject to burglaries overall. Claims of various types are down for homeowners insurance. Shopping it as well will really be important. And being with a mutual insurer is a dividing line. Because remember, mutual insurers are owned by their policyholders. And their purpose is only supposed to be about serving you. And in an era where the costs of providing insurance are lower and may stay lower for a good time to come, being with a mutual insurer could be a big advantage for your wallet. It's time for your questions that you posted for me at clark.com/ask. Producers Kim and Joel alternating, with Kim up first.
All right, this is from Miguel in California, and in terms of getting the best credit score possible, is it a good idea to pay before the current month is over? That way I have a zero balance before it's reported to the credit bureaus?
For credit cards, absolutely, positively, having your balance as low as possible on the statement closing date improves the ratios on your bills. And I did an experiment to see what difference it would make. I'm not somebody who has a lot of traditional loans. I have no auto loans, no mortgage loans. I got no loans of any kind, except I use credit cards as a payment system. And so the range of credit I'm being judged on is more narrow. I historically have used about 10% of my available credit, and which is a very low rate. You want your use of available credit to stay below 30%. And I'm a net payer. I pay my bills in full. Well, I tried an experiment over the last many months, and I've been paying my credit card bills before statement closing date. And my now use of available credit has dropped to 1%. My credit score, for the first time ever, is really close to the perfect 850. Lately, it's been right about 835, 837, and it's because of manipulating when I'm paying bills, not how much I'm paying towards them. Because the amount of your available credit you're using is roughly a third of what makes up your credit score. Joel?
Clark Wayne in Georgia says, I keep reading articles about our cash system going away in January. If I've got cash on hand and that happens, if we make a transition to like a digital cash or cashless system, does the value of paper bills go away completely?
I'm glad that you've posted this question for me, because there is nothing like that happening in the United States. There are moves that have happened in other countries, for example, where paper checks no longer exist, that all the equivalent of checks are electronic, because there's no reason for our analog kind of paper check system in the United States. There are countries where people of their own volition have gone overwhelmingly to paying for things electronically in everyday life, not even using plastic, you know, the actual plastic of a credit card or payment card. So these things are happening, but something where the government invalidates paper money, nothing like that is in the plans. Something like that could eventually happen, but we'll know years and years ahead of time. An example I can give you is long ago when Europe adopted the euro, people's money in other currencies, the German mark, the French franc, the Italian lira, that kind of thing, the money and currencies that no longer were normally usable, people were given 5 years to go to a financial institution and convert that into euros. If we ever went to a transition away from being able to use paper money, there would be a long ramp for you to be able to convert your money and never worry about losing its value. Kim?
James in Florida says, my daughter needs to buy a car and wants my help. She and her husband are both in transition because of the pandemic wiped out their jobs. They are moving to a new area where they are starting the process of building new careers. They will land on their feet, I am sure of this, but at this point, they cannot get a car loan. I'm retired and I'm not comfortable loaning her the money because of the way my finances are structured. However, I do have a HELOC and I would be happy to take a draw for her on the amount she needs. She would be paying me back monthly. What do you think about this plan?
You're doing something out of love that is the kind of thing a parent does for a child, but it does have consequences for you because you're then taking debt against your home. And if she is not able to honor her obligation to you because of the instability of the job market for she and her husband, then you are at risk with having to make sure you make those payments yourself and maybe not having that money back. So this is something that I understand you doing this out of love for your daughter, and just know that it does come with risk, not risk-free. And you know your daughter, you know whether or not even in hard times and push comes to shove, she'll get those payments made. If that's the case, you can go ahead and do this, but do it with your eyes wide open and do it out of love. Joel?
Clark Spencer in Arizona says, I've heard you talk about credit freezes before, but what's your opinion on credit locks? Is it worth doing in order to have an added layer of protection from possible exposure on the dark web?
That's not a reason to do credit lock. And this whole thing about the dark web is way oversold. The reason the credit bureaus want people to do credit lock instead of credit freeze, it's an invention of their own that comes up short versus the laws governing credit freeze, is with credit lock, the credit bureaus still are able to make most of the money they make from you by selling off their dossiers on you over and over and over again, where with credit freeze, your file that they built on you is kept private, and that's better for you. So don't believe anything Equifax, TransUnion, or Experian say about why credit lock is better than credit freeze. They're lying.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Alicia is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Clark. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, I appreciate you. You have served our nation for how many years now?
A little over 21 years.
And which branch of the service are you in?
The Marine Corps.
Oh, a tough person. Okay. Too tough for me. Wow. Was it scary? Can you remember back 21 years ago how scary it was at BASIC?
Oh, I can. Like it was yesterday.
Really? And how long did it take you to get over being frightened?
Not too long. I was actually, you kept so busy all the time that you don't really have much time to think about it.
Well, how can I help you after you have served our nation for so, so long?
Well, I'm getting close to retirement in about 2 to 5 years. So I'm starting to plan for that transition. I'm 39 years old. I have a spouse, no kids. And my concern is that, you know, once I'm retired, if I pass away, my military pension does not go to my spouse unless I pay into the survivor benefit plan, which costs 6.5% of my monthly retirement benefits. And then he would end up with only up to 55% of my retirement benefits. So I'm wondering if there is a better option.
You say only, but it's still potentially a very worthwhile thing to take your pension benefit mm-hmm. down to 93.5 cents each month of what it would be per dollar, so that mm-hmm. your spouse would get a little bit more than half of a second to die benefit, could be a complete game changer. The alternative is doing life insurance as a possible mm-hmm. way to do it. And the problem is, though, someone getting a lump sum life insurance policy payoff in the event of your untimely demise, it's hard for somebody to figure out how to turn that into a reliable, ongoing, monthly stream of income. So mm-hmm. I think that taking the little hit in the monthly pension benefit is worth it so that a surviving spouse has a little bit more than half a pension. And you could supplement that mm-hmm. with a life insurance policy. At 39, unless you have some kind of extreme pre-existing condition, you should qualify for very affordable rates on life insurance. You could buy a level term insurance policy for, let's say, you buy a 25 or 30 year window. You'd not have to worry mm-hmm. at all about your spouse outliving you and how they would be financially. Is that life insurance would be okay. dirt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But doing the reduction in pension and doing life insurance rather than doing either or, to me, is the best answer. And once again, thank you so much for your service. I'm so glad you're with us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about your empowerment with knowledge so you can keep more of what you have. I'm dedicated to helping you navigate all the difficult and ongoing decisions that we have to make that add up to us having control over our lives. I want you to know the tools of the trade and the ways that you can make decisions that over time will create independence for you financially. So you expect from me really solid advice, good information you can act on. If I give advice that doesn't sound right or come up short in answer to somebody, please go to clark.com/clarkstinks and let me and others know where you feel an answer I gave was incomplete or wrong. And then weekly, producers Kim and Joel look through posts on Clark Stinks and share highlights with you right here.
I should have never encouraged you to speak.
You must think I'm pretty stupid.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe you're right, pal.
Okay, Clark, this week we're going to start with one from the message board. This is from Johnny. He says, Clark, you recently indicated that finding paper towels is no longer a problem. According to this article from the Wall Street Journal, there is still a problem. And he links over to an article entitled, Why There Are Still Not Enough Paper Towels.
Yes, and I have read that article, and the reality is that paper towels are not reliably available like we had pre-pandemic, but they are still routinely available. And I was trying to draw a distinction with, if you think about toilet paper and paper towels, there was a period of time that people were ready to fight over a container of Charmin, you know, because when you got to go, you got to go. And people couldn't find toilet paper at all and paper towels. And so the level of shortage, when you look at industry stats, is a tiny fraction of what it was back in March, April, and early May. It does mean there will be spot shortages. The Wall Street Journal article went in depth to how paper towels are manufactured. If you ever have trouble falling asleep at night, you can read that in depth. You'll never make it to the end before you fall asleep. But there are specifics involved in the complexity of the manufacturing of paper towels, which is why the industry cannot simply significantly increase the production of paper towels. But as far as the shortages that we had where there seemed to be no availability, we're way past that with paper products. We still have a severe one on things like Clorox wipes and things like that that will go on for at least potentially another year and a half. Joel?
Clark John says, two of your podcasts mentioned Boost Mobile's $10 a month and $15 a month plans. When I called them to inquire, they told me I had to purchase a phone from them at full price in order to qualify. So, Clark, did you get bad information on this one?
You do not have to, unless they've changed the rules. You don't have to buy a phone from them. You only have to have a phone that's compatible with their network, which is actually T-Mobile's network now under a long-term lease. There's been a lot of confusion about the $10 a month plan because Boost makes you go into a store to sign up for it. But there is no requirement, looking at the terms of service, that requires that you buy a phone. But they have phones. If you needed a phone that would be compatible, here's what it says. Some phones may only be, the phones listed on this page reflect those compatible with expanded network phones, blah, 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 blah. So they have a section where you can see whether or not the phone you have is compatible, but they do offer a number of phones that are not the most exciting phones in the world that are not particularly expensive if the phone you have is not compatible with their network. And I'm sorry if I did not do a good job explaining that. I'm looking at one of the ones they have is just $39, but not a phone that I particularly would want to use, but I'm a high volume user and these plans are for low volume users. Kim?
Hey, Clark, for that last one, do you think John's confusion might be because you have to be a new customer?
He said you had to buy a new phone. As best I know, you can't even sign up for the plan if you have been a Boost customer in the last 120 days.
Excellent info. All right, moving back on to people who have problems with you. This is from April, and she says, you really don't stink that much, but please stop saying, that's a really good question, about every single question. It wastes time, and it is repetitive.
Good point, good point. There may be times that I do a crutch like that and say a phrase like that while I'm trying to turn the computer chip on in my brain to come up with the best answer to the question. And I may say something like that as buying time mindlessly, but I really do appreciate the thought that goes into the questions that people post for me. So I will try to remind myself not to use that phrase too much. Joel.
Clark Harry says, a recent caller asked how to find out the compensation of the management of a charitable organization. The caller did not want to give money if the managers were receiving really high salaries, and that's a valid concern. I know of one small charity that pays its founder over $2 million per year. But Clark, you didn't answer that question. charitable organizations are required to file Form 990 annually with the IRS. That form must disclose the compensation of each of the highest paid employees. The forms are a public record and can be found on the IRS website. Many charities put their recent Form 990 on their own website too, and a lot of those forms can be seen there.
That is great advice. And the reason usually I don't go the 990 route when I'm answering a question about charities, and I should have in that case, because the person who posted that question specifically asked about salaries, is that what I'm always focused on is overall, how efficiently does a charity spend the money donated to it for the service delivery that they claim to offer, rather than feathering the nests of the insiders. And so that's why I talk about Charity Watch, Charity Navigator, and Give, all.orgs. But your answer that you posted is a much better answer than the one I gave to the question I was asked. I appreciate it. Kim?
Jeffrey says, Clark, what happened to letting the market decide? If Apple wants to charge app developers more than their Android counterparts, then let the consumer decide if they want to pay the premium for the luxury of owning an iPhone. The last thing we need is the government telling businesses how to run their business.
That is a great point, and is true only to a point, though, because Apple is an incredibly powerful organization, is using its market strength to interfere with the business operations of others. If you think back to how we historically accessed information or entertainment, it was on a laptop or desktop computer where you were free to go to any function you wanted to, and nobody could put up a toll gate. What's different in the case of the Apple Store is that in the App Store, when you download an app, Apple is putting up a huge toll bridge that hurts the company that is supplying a service to you and is, by the way, destroying a lot of information sites that you might like to use by pricing what they have out of the marketplace. And in the case of a game or whatever, Apple, by interfering in the free market and allowing people to pay the fees outside of Apple's orbit or inside Apple's orbit at a higher price, by saying you can't even make that choice as a consumer, in my opinion, is engaging in a gross antitrust violation, which the courts ultimately will decide, not me. Joel?
Clark Raj says, I appreciate you and listen to you every day. One thing that always bothers me, though, is when you speak in negative terms about the big banks. My wife and I both work for Bank of America. We've worked there for the past 4 to 5 years, and our experience has been wonderful as an employee and as a consumer. They donate a ton of money in the Charlotte community and around there, and they employ around 200,000 people. And this year in the pandemic, they offered $100 per day for each employee to take care of their child so they don't have to stress about the work-life balance. I've worked for high-tech companies in the past, and the culture at Bank of America is great and incredibly supportive of their employees.
First things first, I'm thrilled for you that they have been a great employer and that they've treated you very well. And I feel bad that I have hurt your pride by saying what I say about the giant monster mega banks. And it's just that culturally, in terms of how they deal with the customer, it's a very different experience than it would be at a smaller institution. And so I believe that individual consumers, and especially small businesses, will find better deals and better service elsewhere. But on a particular note, I wanted to mention, Bank of America is a much better run bank than it was at one time. They used to represent a very, very high percent of the complaints we'd hear about banks. And we hear very few complaints about Bank of America anymore. Kim?
Don says, Stinky Dinky Chicken Winky, Clark.
That's fun.
It's very cute. Recently, a caller claimed that he had 5 to 6 months of emergency funds, and then he went on to say that he had $6,000 in saving, a $3,000 stock sale, and $10,000 in credit card debt. Clark, you're a rock star, but you're too nice. You missed the chance to set this guy straight on emergency funds.
So I have to be careful where somebody is in their lives at that moment and how I answer a question involving them. And in that's a case where, if you remember, I was talking about the importance of getting rid of that credit card debt and getting their finances in a position to do that. I didn't feel that there was any need for me to scold that individual. It was more important, I felt, to educate about better ways to handle their money. People are more likely to be more honest in laying out their larger financial picture if they are not in fear that I'm going to embarrass them in any way. We're all works in progress. Wayne is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Wayne.
Hey, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. So, Wayne, you're going out on your own. You're going to run your own business?
Yep, that's what I'm going out to do. So I'm going from a W-2 employee to 1099 and wondering what I need to know about doing that.
Well, there are both joys and pain in going out on your own from having been working for a company. Are you going to be working as a captive contractor for the same people you worked for before, or are you truly going out on your own?
Same industry, but with a different company.
Okay. So now you are a free agent. And
correct.
So with that, it means you're going to pay double the freight on your Social Security, where you pay both the employer and employee portions. And so that'll be 15.3% instead of 7.65. The second aspect of this is that you are responsible for your own health coverage and your own retirement. So what are you thinking of doing about health coverage?
Actually, my wife has shopped that for me, and we've found some, I don't know if I want to call it reasonable, but some decent rates out there.
Okay. And do you know, is it a true, real health insurance policy, or is it something that's more like a health reimbursement plan that covers some things but not others?
The way I understand it, it's a real insurance policy.
Okay, great. And then for retirement, what were you doing at the company you were at all these years that you were with to save for retirement?
I was putting in... there was a company match, and I was putting in about 10%. So my thought was now to start putting into a Roth.
All right. And so that is absolutely a great thing to do. You have multiple possibilities now that you're going to be self-employed, and the Roth is certainly the easiest way to get going and get started. In general terms, what do you expect to make running the business yourself instead of working for somebody?
In the low six figures.
Low six figures. All right. So that's very promising and very exciting. So you may want more flexibility than doing a Roth IRA. You will have the ability to do something known as a SEP, a simplified employee pension, which allows you to put aside more money for retirement. In addition, you have the option of doing, are you going to be the only employee of your firm? Will you be
yes.
a one-person company? You also have the option of doing what's known as a self-employed or solo 401k. So you've got multiple choices here. As you get started with this business, the first year, doing the Roth is great, but it's not going to get you to saving 10% of your pay. And
okay.
that's why you want to look maybe in your second year when you're really comfortable running your own business at doing the SEP or doing the solo 401k. You also need to know one other thing. You probably need to pay what are known as quarterly estimates. Has anybody mentioned that to you?
I've seen some topics on that, and I wasn't too sure if I should wait until I'm told to pay quarterlies.
No, you pay them before you're told, because if you wait till you're told, you're going to be paying penalties to the IRS. And depending on your state, maybe to your state as well. So definitely figure out the estimated payment thing. It's not that hard. You just pay in based on your guesstimate of what you've made in the prior quarter. You pay that money in, and it reduces any hassles later and costs later with the IRS. And I hope you love being your own boss, because let me tell you, it's great. You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. Thanks for joining us today. The Clark Howard Show is produced by Kim Drobes, Joel Larsgaard, Deborah Reese, and Jim Ayers. And remember, 24 hours a day, we're there to serve you at Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com.